Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And we've made it to Friday here in the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, you know, we've been talking a lot this week about the travails of a couple likely presidential candidates. One is already officially in, and that's Newt Gingrich, who, I don't know if VH1 still has the show Worst Week Ever or Best Week Ever, but pretty sure if they had one Worst Week Ever, he'd probably qualify for that, despite his blaming everyone else on the planet for his problems. But there's another man who's getting on the scene who has probably not gotten much attention other than the fact that he once worked for President Obama as ambassador to China, and that's former Utah Republican Governor John Huntsman, who seems very likely to be joining the race, although name ID seems to be one of his biggest challenges at the time. He was the guest of George Stephanopoulos on Good Morning America, since Huntsman is spending several days in New Hampshire trying to raise his profile and make himself quite appealing to the folks up there. Here's what Huntsman had to say when Stephanopoulos pointed out that Huntsman actually wanted a larger stimulus package back in 2009. Huntsman says yes, but structured much, much differently.
You will find that I was specifically referring to corporate tax cuts, payroll tax deductions, and focusing the stimulus in infrastructure projects that would improve our economic future.
And Jim, there's other things in this interview that I think most conservatives will like. He wonders why in the world we're actually in Libya. He wants to repeal Obamacare, says he's in favor of the Ryan plan. I think there are other conservatives who are going to have very difficult problems with Huntsman for the fact that he supports civil unions. He's still kind of a squish when it comes to cap and trade. He's not the strongest on border security. And it just seems on a lot of questions, he tends to equivocate, including whether or not he's still a Mormon. I don't think that's as big of an issue as it has been in recent campaigns, but the fact he can't just say yes or no probably bugs a few people. In the campaign spot, you're pretty impressed by him.
Well, the thing I would note, and I think what's probably most interesting, is that after a week, as you're right, that Newt Gingrich basically, his appearance on Meet the Press last Sunday guaranteed that he was going to have the worst week ever. After writing about him in like four straight Morning Jolt newsletters, I was like, all right, I can't write about him yesterday. And there was still a ton of new material about him going on Rush Limbaugh and insisting he wasn't really talking about Ryan, even though everybody in the world interpreted his comments about Ryan. So I just found it interesting that John Huntsman, purportedly the rhino in the race, purportedly the moderate, purportedly the squish, comes out and he's like, oh yeah, I'd vote for Ryan. Yeah, in a heartbeat. And, you know, even the Medicare stuff, and he tells Stephanopoulos that he believes that the Medicare stuff may be politically difficult, but the scale of the financial crisis requires it. So I think that's an interesting – it's been a teachable moment that the Ryan plan is now – almost a necessity for a serious Republican presidential candidate, and that this mishandling is this badly may have made Newt not that serious. If you'd said at the beginning of the week who's going to be backing Ryan and who's going to be have completely mishandled it, most people would have put their money on Newt being the guy going with the tough conservative position and Huntsman being the guy who was nervous about it. So kind of a fascinating thing there. I think Huntsman is – when you're going through the list, I think when judging by the comment section and judging by my email – the biggest obstacle for Huntsman is the fact that he was Obama's ambassador to China. And a lot of folks just say, well, if you work for the guy, you can't be that conservative. You can't be that Republican. You turn coat, go away. The chances of Huntsman getting the nomination are pretty slim. But I'd love to see a Obama-Huntsman general election fight in which Obama's got to say, this man is an extremist. This man is out of his mind. This man will destroy America. And that's why I made him my ambassador to China. If he's such a right-wing maniac, why did you have him, you know, your voice in one of your most important ambassadorial posts? And what does it say about your judgment in putting him there? So not likely to happen. But I think Huntsman's an intriguing character. And I think when you find, you know, you listen to some of these positions he took, your first instinct when you hear he wanted a bigger stimulus is, you know, a lot of conservatives, probably the hairs on the back of their neck stand up. But then when you hear him say he wanted it more heavily weighted towards tax cuts and corporate income taxes and cutting the payroll tax, you know, I think the biggest problem a lot of folks have with the stimulus is that it didn't work. You know, that we spend $1 billion and or I should say $787 billion and the unemployment rate just kept going up and up and up. And, you know, if it was larger but more effective, I think a decent number of fiscal conservatives might have been willing to live with that, because if unemployment was much lower, more people would be paying in taxes and the economy would be thriving, et cetera, et cetera. So an intriguing guy to watch. I think, you know, the Huntsman may be a slightly more competitive figure than a lot of people had thought heading into this cycle.
I think a lot of people want to like John Huntsman because he was an extremely popular governor, and by all accounts, even though he was serving President Obama, pretty effective ambassador to China, and obviously many problems persist in our trade relationship with China, but he seems like a competent guy. He was very popular, elected twice, but he's got some questions to answer and just get out there and make his views known on a lot of key issues because, like we said before, name ID seems to be the biggest issue. So yeah,
this is what primaries are for, Greg.
Absolutely. On to number two now, and let's talk about the current president and his much ballyhooed speech on the Middle East yesterday. He said many things about supporting anyone who wants democratic reforms in any part of the Middle East, which is drawing different reactions depending on one's viewpoint. But here's the line that got him in the most hot water.
We believe the borders of Israel and Palestine should be based on the 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps, so that secure and recognized borders are established for both states. The Palestinian people must have the right to govern themselves and reach their full potential in a sovereign and contiguous state.
Love the dramatic Obama pause there. Not sure if the teleprompter hadn't caught up or what that was, but clearly...
A lot of people speculate he was waiting for applause and just didn't show up for some reason. A lot to unpack in that, Greg, but the first thing that jumps out at me, and I'm kind of scratching my head over it, is contiguous. Obviously, the Palestinians are based in the West Bank. They're based in the Gaza Strip. Israel is in between the two. I guess the thinking is that, you know, part of this redrawing of the borders would involve a very tiny highway width stretch of Israel, which would be split in half, basically.
Yep.
These two parts. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, Greg, we're not contiguous with Alaska. And that seems to be doing okay, right? I mean, you know, maybe there's some, you know, crazy Sarah Palin critics out there. But otherwise, you know, that's working okay for us. There's a piece of Russia that's separated by the Baltic states and, you know, they're doing all right. So the idea that, you know, the West Bank and Gaza have to be connected to be part of some peace deal strikes me as a, you know, an angle I'm not yet, you know, hey, let's split one country in half to make peace. Somehow I don't think that will bring about the result. I've always been a skeptic of the idea that the President of the United States can somehow push a button and make a peace between two people who've been, you know, at each other's throats for centuries. There's a certain arrogance to this notion that if the President of the United States just is creative enough and clever enough in drawing lines on a map, that somehow a population that is, you know, pledging to drive this other group to the sea, and I'm talking about the Palestinians, and, you know, the problem with the Palestinians is they want to kill the Israelis, and the problem with the Israelis in the eyes of the Palestinians is that they refuse to die. And that tends to, you know, there's really not a middle ground in there. They can't agree to be maimed or something. There's not a good halfway compromise area. So I've always been a skeptic going back to, you know, the Clinton years. We'll see what happens out of this. My guess is that this will, you know, have the same slow, painful death as every other Middle East peace initiative. But if it comes out with a better result, I'll be quite happy. But my doubt is you need to change basically the culture and the character of the Palestinian people. Much more than any particular line on the map being a problem.
First of all, I'm not sure that the people of the West Bank really want to be connected to Gaza. That seems pretty much like a cesspool at this point, totally ruled by Hamas. And if there is a moderate wing of the Palestinian people, it's certainly in the West Bank as opposed to Gaza. Secondly, the president's equivocation, and basically when he talked about how people on both sides want peace, and he says, you know, the Israeli person who lost their child when the Hamas rockets came into Israel and killed their child still wants peace, isn't going to let hate rule them. And the same for the person in Gaza when Israel came in and their child was killed, as if that the two military actions were equivalent. The Israeli's action was completely in response to the terrorist activities of Hamas. So to just let that fly like that and basically give both sides equal footing in where this standoff lies is not very encouraging right now. And I'm guessing there's going to be a pretty icy standoff between the president and Prime Minister Netanyahu in Washington today. The only question is, who will the president have dinner with instead of Netanyahu when they can't agree on anything? Because I, for one, like the fact that there is an Israeli prime minister who has a backbone, who's willing to stand up for Israel, since our president's not.
Maybe there's hope for Canadians. maybe David Cameron in the UK will clear his throat in a disapproving way towards the Palestinians or something. It's kind of fascinating when our concept of even-handedness is to say to the Israelis, how dare you shoot back?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, what were you thinking, returning fire like that? It's, you know.
We used to be the ones at the UN who would not allow the other countries to pass resolutions condemning it. Now we're seeming to join their side, unfortunately.
Yeah. I had seen a few folks on Twitter saying that you look at the reaction amongst the chattering class in Washington and the reaction from beyond the Beltway in the heartland. There is this big gap there, because I think to have a peace process, you have to be somewhat even-handed, and you have to basically treat both actors in the party as equally responsible and equally capable of holding up their ends of the bargains, et cetera. And I think most Americans just don't see it that way. I mean, we look at Israel and we see a country that's similar to us in a lot of ways. And we look at the Palestinians and we see a bunch of maniacs who jump up and down and dance when 9/11 occurs, and who basically see them as willing to send kids to be suicide bombers, and a culture we just can't get our heads around. So the idea that we should be some sort of, well, let's not play favorites here, strikes Americans as spectacularly, alienly wrongheaded. Not, something that just is a completely different psychology. I guess I just spent a lot of time studying the problem before it suddenly makes sense to you.
Apparently so. On to our third and crazy martini very quickly here today. And, Jim, it goes back a couple weeks now to all the different stories we heard out of the White House and the Pentagon and the CIA about what exactly happened during the bin Laden raid. Was there a firefight? Was it over within a few seconds? Were there human shields? Were there not human shields? Did anybody resist? All this sort of thing. So Leon Panetta, the director of the CIA, soon to be Secretary of Defense most likely, sends out a memo saying, end of the leaks. And now we know about that memo because somebody leaked the memo that says, don't leak anymore.
Somewhere Julian Assange is saying, dang, missed that one. It's one of those things where you almost get the feeling you wish Panetta would just call up the Washington Post and dictate the memo directly. Right. If it's going to end up there anyway. By the way, it's interesting that earlier in the week, Robert Gates certainly had made it suggest that they had agreed in the Situation Room that no one should talk about the details of the operation. And he said that lasted about 12 hours. And he certainly didn't seem to indicate that it wasn't anybody at the Pentagon who was doing that chat. The tone of his comments suggested it was coming from the White House. Now, we were all told not to spike the football because we can't see those photos, because apparently it wouldn't be good sportsmanship or something. Now, you know me. I'd rather do more touchdown dances than the University of Miami Hurricanes in their glory years when it comes to killing bin Laden. But I guess apparently, listen, CIA personnel, don't leak any of that good stuff. That's, leave that to the hands of the professional leakers at the White House.
I also appreciate the fact that the president once again reminded us that bin Laden was dead yesterday, which was met with no applause, I think, because people have heard it so many times, it's just almost numb to them at this point. Because
he just should have used the Chevy Chase line, this just handed to me, Osama bin Laden is still dead.
Exactly. That probably would have been much better for his sake. Jim, have a fantastic weekend. We'll talk to you again Monday.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.